Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
So he started taxiing on the runway pretty rapidly because I think he wanted to beat the typhoon. So I was on a plane. I was sitting in number, I think, 22. I requested a seat. Nobody was next to me, so I was watching People magazine. And we hit the liftoff speed, 165 miles per hour. And my portion of the plane was up in the air. And then I heard this noise, like somebody knocking on the door. I'd say, what the heck is that? Obviously, something really bad happened.
Welcome to How I Built This, a show about innovators, entrepreneurs, idealists, and the stories behind the movements they built. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, how William Wong lost his first business, almost lost his life, and then built one of the best-selling television brands in the country, Vizio. There are a number of ways to break into a crowded market. One of them is through branding. You differentiate by creating a culture around the product, kind of like how Liquid Death managed to break into the $300 billion bottled water category. Another way is to just price your product so comparatively low that consumers notice. So, for example, Harry's razors, which were designed to compete against more expensive brands like Gillette. And this is the playbook that William Wong used, not once, but twice. The first time was in the 1990s when he built a company that made cheap, high-quality computer monitors. Even though big players like IBM dominated the category, William managed to undercut their price and build a pretty significant business. That is, until the bottom fell out and the company went broke. But that didn't stop him from trying again. The next time was with flat-screen TVs. In the early 2000s, a flat-screen TV would set you back $13,000 to $15,000. But William believed that with the right efficiencies, he could build a flat-screen TV and sell it for under $3,000. His brand was called Vizio, and within just a few years, he built it into a massive business that now sells smart TVs, soundbars, and targeted ads on its own platform. In 2024, Vizio was acquired by Walmart for $2.3 billion. And if all of that weren't enough of a story, as you will hear, when William was already reeling from debt incurred when his first business failed, he experienced something even more catastrophic, a plane crash. In the year 2000, he survived a horrific accident during a typhoon, which killed scores of his fellow passengers. He flew safely home a few days later and then started the company that would become Vizio. William Wong was born in the early 1960s in Taiwan. When he was 14, his family settled in Southern California, where adjusting to American life was hard. For starters, William barely spoke any English.
It's hard. I don't, no friend, right? And don't know anybody. It's tough as a kid. You know, I want to try out sports. I had no idea how to do it. And of course, I failed. You know, just difficult.
Were there a lot of Chinese kids around when you were growing up?
No, I was 78. I came to Huntington Beach and little upscale neighborhood.
Now very upscale, but back in 78 was, I think, middle class. But you grow up, complete outsider. But I imagine that your parents had high expectations for you because they made a big sacrifice to come to the United States and to start over. Is that fair to say that they expected a lot out of you?
Well, having good, Chinese parents, of course, they want me to go get a PhD or something. So
yeah,
that was always the expectation. So
yeah,
in high school, because of disconnect, you know, for a couple of years. My GPA was, it's okay, you know. My math is pretty good. Of course, my English was poor. And I think my GPA in high school was like 3.3.
Mm-hmm. But back respectable. Then, respectable.
Yeah, respectable. Yeah. So my GPA wasn't good enough for UCLA, wasn't good enough for Stanford, Berkeley. But somehow I did. I got into USC. And my mom, she highly recommended to become an engineer because, you know, the high-paid jobs are engineers and like $30,000 a year. So I got into electrical engineer at USC, which is kind of not my personal favorite. I want to be, I like art. I want to be a, I want to be an architect. But it's all right. I think I don't know any better too. I just follow my mom's guidance.
And, advice. Yeah.
Yes.
So, and by the way, I mean, today, a 3.3, you would not get into USC, right? Much harder today
I know.
To get into.
I don't even but, think but, you can get into USC at 4.3 now.
No, it's very hard. It's a completely changed, but a wise decision you made because you've got a USC degree, which is a very prestigious degree. And from what I understand, out of college, you get a job working for a company that made computer monitors, I guess. It was like a sales job. Is that right?
Yeah, no, technical support, answering phone calls.
Technical support, okay.
It's a Taiwanese company. It's called Datong. It's the biggest consumer electronic company in Taiwan.
Yeah, Datong, right? I remember.
They're famous for rice cookers.
Mm-hmm. Didn't they have a commercial? Datong. Didn't they have that commercial on TV?
Yeah.
I remember that commercial.
Amazing. Yeah, we grew up with that commercial. And so I was hired as the first technical support / customer service because, it's first of all, I was born in Taiwan, so I know their culture. I speak the language. So they hired me pretty cheap. I mean, it wasn't $30,000 a year. It was... My salary was $1,750 a month. And my boss said, hey, you're pretty good at telling the story of why the computer monitor should be better or why is our monitor better. Why don't you try sales? So I say, okay, I'll give it a shot.
So you're really focused on now in sales, selling Datong computer monitors. But I guess around 4 years into it, you're 25, 26, maybe 27, I don't know. You get frustrated there and you decide to leave and start your own monitor company. Tell me the story about that. What was going on?
Yeah, there were multiple reasons. I was 26 years old and I was so jealous. Every Saturday when they had this management class, only the senior manager can attend. I say, how come I wasn't invited? I wanna know more. So I went to my boss, say, can I go? Can I do that? He said, no, you're too young. I already got promoted from like nobody to director of sales marketing at that time. I say, okay, but you guys know nothing about this business. So I know better than all of you. I should be the next in line to be a VP. And then my boss's boss say, no, you need more time. And when my previous VP left, and I saw definitely I'm the next in line. And he went to do something else on his own. All of a sudden, he dropped somebody else to replace him who know nothing about computer monitor. And I just think he was a wimp. Okay,
wimp.
And I say, I can't work for this guy. At the same time, I really fell in love with the computer monitor industry, and I know this industry very well. I know the problem with the industry. At that time, the computer monitor, the spec on the monitor was fully controlled by IBM.
Right, based on their specs, because based IBM dominated the PC market.
Yeah, exactly.
Or IBM clones, yeah.
Yeah, everything's called IBM compatible.
Compatible, yes.
They use the TV interlacing technology to do computer monitor. I look at it and say, this is not good for a consumer. The resolution is too low. You're going to kill people's eyes. And I look at it as it's flickering, right? It's refreshing at 30 hertz, meaning 30 times a second.
And just to for simplicity reasons here, this is the frequency, right, that powers the cycles right here.
Right.
And so 60 hertz would mean a better quality monitor, essentially, in short,
yeah.
You know,
60 hertz meaning just for every second, each screen refresh 60 times.
Right. There's less lag.
There's no lag. Yeah, exactly.
No lag.
So
yeah. Right.
I couldn't take it. I say, there's a golden opportunity to build something a little better. You can easily turn it into 60 hertz. Mm-hmm. It's not hard. You just spend a little bit more money. So I went all the way out to the chairman of the company, Da Tong. He told me, who's your customer? I say, we'll build it. Customer will come. He say, no, we're IBM. Everybody else is not our customer. We don't want to build it. So he shut me down.
Yep.
So that's one of the main reasons. Again, I left. I say, I'm going to build it myself. If IBM want to build this, my company will build that.
This is the classic story. You know, the young upstart has an idea. They bring it to the boss. The boss says no, and the upstart gets frustrated, and they leave. And that's basically what happened, right?
Yeah.
And you said, all right, I'm going to try to figure this out myself. This is 1990. What did that – I mean, first of all, how did you even get the money to start a computer monitor? I guess you had experience now. You knew where the factories were in Taiwan. You knew kind of had an understanding of how they were manufactured, but you still needed money. And in 1990, you know, to raise the money wasn't easy. Who did you go to?
At that time, Da Tong was also buying from other suppliers.
Yep.
So I got pretty lucky because I know all the factories. And
yeah.
So one of the suppliers would build for Da Tong, which I know very well. They're hungry like me. And they're pretty much a similar age. And he raised a lot of money to do their own computer monitor manufacturing.
So wait, so this person you're talking about, this person you pitched your idea to, he was like a supplier or a factory owner in China?
Yeah. So the opportunity I presented, they say, God, we want to do that, right? So they're very entrepreneurial in spirit. And they say, if you do this, I'll give you $150,000.
Right.
So he gave me $150,000. So I went to my dad and I put together $50,000. Like some of them from my dad, some of them from my own saving after 4 years of working. Then I told my boss and my bosses, I'm leaving. The funny part was... my boss's boss, the chairman of the company of Da Tong US, he say, oh, well, yeah, we really like you. I think you're definitely worthwhile to invest in. So he gave me $150,000.
Wow.
So, you know, I've 27 years old, I found $350,000. And I just started the business. Don't understand balance sheet, don't understand income statement. Never run a company in my life.
Wow. All right. So you start your business to make competing monitors, better monitors. You call it Mag Innovision, I think.
Yes.
And this is, I mean, it's a kind of a fortuitous time because 1990, I mean, this is, people think of the 80s as a time when the PC boom really happened, but it was really the 90s when so many more people brought personal computers into their homes, in part because the internet was coming and Windows made it easier to use PCs. Before in the 80s, it was DOS, you know, and so now in the 90s, ordinary people without a lot of skills could figure out how to use a Windows PC, meaning lots of people needed monitors. So if, you know, there was one standard, which was the IBM specs, and you could improve on it, you could stand out, I guess, right?
Yes, absolutely. That was the crazy time in this industry. I mean, back then, if you can't build CAN monitor, you would sell them out. And if you can't build...
selling out.
Oh, God. The PC, personal computer, was in great demand.
Yeah. And they're getting cheaper and, you know, so, right? I mean, all things
were
happening.
Cheaper and cheaper. You can't get enough monitor. You can't get enough memory chips. And the technology was growing at such a rapid speed. Speed, you went from the hard drive went from 10 meg to 20 meg to 50 to, you know, just
yeah,
nonstop innovation from in the 90s for a personal computer. And this whole industry was on fire.
In your case, where were you selling the monitors? Were you selling them through retail stores, or were you selling them to PC makers as a bundle, like where they would sell it with their computers?
I found a really key customer called Gateway.
Gateway, yeah, sure.
Yeah, Gateway 2000 back then it's called, because we're the same age, and I used to go visit them a lot, and we think alike. We say, better technology, lower price. Better technology, lower price. And they were able to make PC cheaper by selling direct, because they were mail order. They weren't e-commerce. There was no e-commerce back then, but they were mail order.
Yeah.
So they bypassed everybody by making the computer so much cheaper. So they became one of my biggest customers, and whatever I made, they sold.
So, all right. So Gateway is your biggest customer, like 80% of your sales?
Yeah, I would say 70, 80%.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
This is key, because I think within 6 years, you guys are doing $600 million in revenue. So you really like caught a wave here. I mean, this was massively growing, massively fast. You had 400 employees for Mag Innovision. Just very briefly, William, how were you able to make a cheaper product that was better quality? Was it, I mean, A, I'm assuming you were making these in China, so that lowered costs. But how else were you able to really compete against these much bigger companies like Tatung?
Yeah, in the very beginning, we're just making it better. My customer made it cheaper, like Gateway. And I keep on, again, in the early 90s, the technology shifts so fast.
Yeah.
We have 14-inch computer screen, 15-inch computer screen, 17-inch computer screen. This is all happening in 3 or 4 years. We had 60 hertz, we had 70 hertz. So my engineering background, I keep on pushing the technology envelope. So in the first 4 years, when it grew so fast, I just focused on technology advancement. And I found a factory to do it. That was the key. I mean, we're building everything offshore. So Taiwan is pretty efficient back then.
I mean, to go from zero to 600 million within 6 years is mind-blowing. I mean, the pace of growth was probably so fast that you had no, I mean, I don't even know how you were able to handle that, because, and by the way, not always a good thing, right? Because it can lead to huge challenges. Very fast, explosive growth like this must have been quite overwhelming.
Yeah, it was way too overwhelming, all right. It was a disaster later on.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about this, because we obviously there's a wave. Gateway, 80%, 70, 80% of your business is coming from Gateway, which on the one hand is amazing, on the other hand is a little scary because you're dependent on Gateway, right? By 1998, your revenue drops to $470 million, and then it really starts to drop further and further from there. Tell me what happens. Is it just competition enters the space? Many more companies are like, wait a minute, we can compete against these guys.
Yeah, exactly. It's a combination of problems, right? The market got so much bigger, so efficiency became a key ingredient for success, and the competitor are coming in like crazy. You know, we're still focused too much on technology, and they were just focused on efficiency, so their cost is more competitive. So I was the only supplier for them, and they want to diversify also. So, you know, Gateway start to buy from other people. Mm-hmm. And because we grew so fast, I mean, we couldn't control our quality. But most importantly, I literally outgrew myself in management capability. I'm still a kid who think technology would dominate everything.
Yeah.
So I wasn't a great manager. I don't have enough. My management team is not strong enough because I didn't hire good enough. Also, I was into too many sectors of the business. I was in the service business, service computer monitor. Mm-hmm. I had an engineer lab designing smart TV in 98.
Already an idea.
Already an idea, yeah.
Way before its time.
Way before its time when internet was still going through modem. And I sunk a lot of money in there. So I wasn't good enough to make it to the next level. The management team was still challenged by me, by the dominance of an entrepreneur like me.
You were a micromanager.
I was a micromanager. Oh, yeah. That's, yeah.
But I mean, but you couldn't see it at that time because you were young and learning. But obviously, on reflection, you realize that because you were involved in every... I mean, there's different arguments that people make about this. That some people say you have to be involved in every detail of the business. Some people say, no, you really have to delegate and trust your people. Sounds like that's where you landed eventually.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I learned the hard way because it's... I was 30 years old. I don't know what management means. And I don't know how to manage my finance, right? Because I thought money would come easily, but money didn't come. And I learned the hard way, pay my tuition. It was tough.
When we come back in just a moment, William faces something even scarier than massive debt, a catastrophic plane crash. Stay with us. I'm Kai Raz, and you're listening to How I Built This. Hey, welcome back to How I Built This. I'm Guy Raz. So, it's 1998, and William's first company, Mag Innovision, has gone from $600 million in revenue to being buried in debt. And William, looking for a way out, decides to sell the business.
I want to pay off my debt.
Yeah.
I couldn't. And I sold companies to the factory under duress.
How much debt did you have at the time?
I think we had $25, $30 million of debts.
And obviously, you had some investors you wanted to pay back, I guess.
Yeah. Well, the investor lost some money.
They lost, yeah.
They lost, yeah, including myself. I'm putting another more money. So the shareholder values all disappeared. And and it was tough. So under duress, we had to settle with the supplier. I tried to, from 98, 99 until 2001, I did nothing but settling debts. So I tried to make money, pay them, make money. So 3 years, I didn't do anything but paying suppliers.
Just to understand, so you sell it under duress. It's amazing because, right, a lot of people from the outside would think, wait, you were doing $600 million in sales just 2 years earlier. This is an incredible success story, and yet... It just shows you how tough that business was, that the bottom fell out and you had to sell it and you were left with nothing. Like, you were broke.
Yeah, nothing.
And you had to pay back the people you owed money to. I mean, here's just a weird question. Couldn't you declare bankruptcy and have those debts forgiven, I guess?
I could, but I mean, that's not my motivation, right? I believe I want to do better for them. We looked at bankruptcy, but I just don't want to do it.
So what was your plan to pay back the debtors, the people that had, that you owed money to? How were you going to pay them back?
I was for example, I know what's a new product. So instead of going through me, I say, you pay me 2% commission. I use that 2% commission to pay you.
So you were doing consulting work for some of the people you owed money to basically for free.
Yeah, for free to pay them off because I want to pay that off. And again, I know a lot of suppliers. And they know I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't take the money or anything. And they still trust me. They just know that during that time, there was a major transition. And it's just poor management on my behalf. So they allowed me to give me some time to use my talent to make some money for them to pay all my debts.
Wow. Okay. So I think this is like a period of at least four years of trying to, doing consulting work in part to try and pay back debts. And I think one of the things you got involved with was helping one of these companies try and figure out like a smart TV and also plasma screen televisions, right?
Yeah. Back then, the plasma TV started to emerge. And very expensive.
They were like $20,000, I think. And I mean, today they cost, like nothing. But back then, I mean, they were super expensive. Meanwhile, I want to talk about smart TVs for a moment because, I mean, this is the late 90s. And, I mean, no one was really interested in them yet, right? But I guess you were, right? You wanted to sort of make them or something that would resemble them, right?
Well, yeah, I just built it. I say, hey, TV should be connected to the internet. I actually had a whole design lab. We lay out a board. We found a software company in Boston to do Linux-based software for us. I found a chip supplier. I put a CPU in the TV and connected to the internet. And when you turn on that TV, first page was apps. Back then, we didn't call it apps. Back then, we called it widgets. Mm-hmm. This is way before iPhone. The TV worked great, but the problem was the internet connectivity was rather slow. So it takes 5 minutes to warm out a TV because it's a modem need to connect. And again, that was 98. And lost all my money.
Wow.
That's part of the...
Part of why your first business went under.
Yeah.
So, all right, let me kind of set the context here because you are financially in crisis at this time, trying to figure out how to pay back debt and also trying to figure out how to make money. I guess both of them are connected. And you are going back and forth between Asia and Southern California to do consulting work and to try and figure out different ideas, you know, that you could generate income from and innovation, but none of them really work. And you get on a flight, October 31st, Halloween, 2000. You're about to fly back, Singapore Airlines flight. You're in Taiwan, and you're going to fly back to Los Angeles. Tell me what happens.
Yeah, so the reason I want to get back that evening was because it was my daughter's first trick-or-treat.
Halloween. You were going to get back, even though you were leaving on the 31st, by the time you get back to LA, it was still the 31st.
It's the 31st. If I leave like 11:30, yeah. I'll get back here like 6:30. I barely make it. I can still see my daughter in
her costume.
In customs. Yeah. So I really want to, she's like 4 years old, 3 years old. So I say, okay, let's do that. And by the time I finished my meeting at 5 o'clock, I came out of the office, started to ring. I don't know what's going on in Taipei, the weather. I didn't pay attention, but a typhoon hit.
It was very stormy that night.
It's very stormy that night. So by the time I got to the airport, Singapore Airlines' terminal, this is kind of creepy. There's nobody around. Most people are not in the airport because I think most people in Taipei don't want to take the flight because of the typhoon. They don't even know that the plane's going to take off or not. But I asked Singapore, if you're taking off, I'm going to be on a plane. I need to go back. So I was the last person on a plane.
This was a Boeing 747, obviously, because it's a transatlantic flight. So big plane.
Yeah. So he started taxiing on the runway pretty rapidly because I think he wanted to beat the wind.
Because what were the winds at? Like 30, 40 miles an hour?
Yeah, I think it's going over. So it's a little bit over 50. I think
over 50, yeah.
I think the 747-400 can still take out on a headwind like 60 miles per hour.
Right.
He just want to beat typhoon. And he want to get out there quick. So we took out rather quickly. But I was on a plane. I was sitting on number, I think, 22. I requested a seat. Nobody was next to me. So I was watching People magazine. And we hit what? The liftoff speed, 165 miles per hour. And my portion of the plane was up in the air. And then I heard this noise, like somebody knocking on the door. I say, what the heck is that? And immediately I started leaning to the left. Obviously, something really bad happened. The last tires of the plane hit the construction equipment and the concrete barricade where they were doing construction works.
It eclipsed the concrete barrier as it's taking off.
As it's taking off. And, you know, now you hear everybody scream. And, you know, the plane obviously came down. And I was in the front of the plane came down. And so I lift my feet up, I lift my hand up. That was my crash position. And the moment right after I lifted on my feet, my hand, the fire came underneath me. Bright orange fire came underneath me. Apparently, the somehow 60,000 gallon of jet fuel exploded, and the plane was torn into two pieces right where the fuselage was. And the fire came underneath me, and once it hit the wall, I thought, okay, this is it. I'm going to get burned. But the fire disappeared right away because it's, I think the fire burned up all the oxygen in the pseudo explosion. It sucked all the oxygen away from the plane.
The images of that of the aftermath are shocking. I mean, it was ripped in half, and you were in the front half of the plane. 96 people survived. 83 people were killed in that flight, and I can't even imagine what that was like. But you, when it stopped, when you could leave your seat and get out, what do you remember?
Well, the fire came underneath me, and the fire disappeared immediately. I couldn't breathe. I was just smoking.
No oxygen. Yeah.
No oxygen. First thing that went through my mind was, I'm dead. And I immediately, within half a second, I thought, oh, wow, I miss all my family. My mom, my dad, my wife, my daughter, my sisters, my brother, everybody. Then next thing flashed through my mind was, I had no more headache and no more stress. I'm kind of relieved because at the time my blood pressure was 160 over 130 constantly because I was under a lot of stress, obviously, because I was in debt. So that was what went through my mind in like 2 seconds.
Because you were going to die.
Yeah.
And that was it.
Yeah. So I unbuckled my seatbelt. The plane was still moving. I unbuckled my seatbelt. I say, I'm going to get out of here. I need to breathe. So I went to the first door on the right. I tried to open that door while the plane was still moving. I couldn't open it, obviously, because the pressure of the plane is still fully engaged. And now I went to the door on the left. When I went from the door on the right to the door on the left, the plane stopped. But the last few seconds, I had no memory. I don't know what happened. And next thing I knew was the door popped open and the rain hit my face.
The rain.
The rain hit my face and door just exploded open. And along with the escape chute and the fire and the smoke rushing out of the plane, it pushed me. I got ejected from the plane.
It's unimaginable, and it's almost a cliche, I guess, which is when somebody has a near-death experience, it does often change their life because it changes their perspective. And from what I gather, that happened to you. I mean, here you were focused on these stressful things about debt and then you go through this experience, and I have to imagine that this was going to fundamentally change the way you saw your life.
Yeah. It's really hard to describe because I'm always super optimistic always. I didn't really look back that much, honestly. Now, it's kind of unfortunate. It is unfortunate, but I didn't want to think too much on that. I never really dig into my own mind. What really happened? What did it really change me? How did it really change me? Because I don't think it's going to help me anyway. So I say, just keep on looking forward. What else can you do? What other problem can you solve? So I really focus on that instead. So yeah, did it really change me? I don't, I'm still the same person.
I guess my question is, did it change what matters to you?
I know I really want to come back home.
Yeah.
that's one thing I really want to do during the fire. I mean, after the plane. That's something I really, really want to do at that time. I really want to be close to my family. And that mattered to me the most versus, you know, anything else. Yeah, you have money, success, a lot of problems to solve, technology. But that doesn't really matter. Yeah. I think the most important thing is love. I kind of differentiate love and passion, I guess. I went to Singapore Airlines next day. I said, get me out of here. I want to go back. It's scary for me.
I mean, I can't imagine like getting on a flight after going through that. Because
yeah, it was tough. I mean, I don't have a sweaty palm. But I had a pretty sweaty palm that flight.
Yeah.
The whole flight. And but that's all right. I know. I just want to get back. I don't care.
So you get back. And eventually you continue with your work, but I guess one of the things that you'd been doing, one of the consulting jobs that you'd been doing, was with your former customer, Gateway. I guess they had retail stores in the U.S. at that time, and they wanted to sell other things besides computers because the market was getting competitive, and presumably they wanted to build out their inventory, their product offering. And you suggested that they look into televisions, into plasma televisions, which were, again, in 2001, really expensive. I mean, they were like $15,000, $20,000. But I guess your idea was, hey, maybe you guys should get into the plasma TV business, but make them really cheap. Tell me about your proposal to them.
Yeah, so I knew high-definition TV is going to be a hot item because U.S. government was really pushing for HD TV. But high definition TV wasn't affordable back then. It was $15,000, $20,000.
Yeah.
So there's a problem. The problem is government want to push digital, and digital TV are not affordable.
And I guess I should point out that the government had required this digital makeover at the time. They wanted televisions to move away from analog to digital video signals, high def. And high def was part of that. And so it required all manufacturers to move from analog televisions with an antenna, essentially, to a new type of digital. Well, there's digital antennas, but a digital, receiving digital video signals.
Yep. Yeah, government wanted to do that desperately. Their mandate was like 1998, 1999, 2000, 2001, 2000. They keep on pushing back.
Right.
Because TV, the Sony and Panasonic of the world and the retailer of the world don't care. Yeah. They're making so much money on analog TV. Why should they give away the digital TV, right? They look at digital TVs as something belong to rich people. So knowing the cost of the components, I say, I think I can build this TV and sell it for like $3,000. Mm-hmm. So I was running around asking for money to fund my new project. And I went to the Consumer Electronics Show to talk to my friends at Gateway. And I say, how about investing in me? I want to do TV. Mm-hmm. At that time, Gateway had like 500 country stores, retail stores.
All across the U.S.
All across the U.S. Mm-hmm. And at 500 U.S. retail store, the personal computer's price point went from like $2,500 average to like $1,000.
Right. So, I mean, at that time, PCs were getting cheaper for consumers, but not much cheaper to make, I guess. Imagine Gateway was just cutting their profit margin in half.
Yeah. So they were suffering because they lost 50% of their margin to support the stores. So they went to the consumer electronics store. They want to know what else to put in the store. And so I went to them and say, oh, I want to, can you invest in me? And so they turn around and say, how about this? Why don't you help us get into this place under the Gateway brand so we can sell it at the Gateway country stores? So later on, they say, okay, in that case, it's, well, we'll pay you 2% of all the revenue you help us generate on TV. And and on top of that, we'll pay you $20,000 a month. So here I say, okay, I started Vizio as a consultant. And my own money has started from my second mortgage, my house, $400,000 to fund my business. I hire a few people. who's been with me for a long time, and we started the business.
So just to clarify, you went to Gateway to pitch them an idea on cheaper plasma TVs, but then you started a business called Vizio?
I started the business as a V Inc.
V Inc. Okay, and V-Inc. And the brand was called V.
The brand initially was called V at the time. So I actually my first TV was V, and
right. And the business was to make plasma televisions for Gateway under their brand.
My original business was selling V TVs, but I had no funding, and Gateway say, "Help us getting to the Gateway brand." I say, "Okay, we'll do Gateway brand instead." So I changed my business plan. I say, "I'll do it because you're paying me."
Got
so
it.
From 2002, 2003, and 2004, the very beginning of the Vizio, V-In later became Vizio.
Yeah,
we were making money from Gateway. So I went to Asia, set up a factory for them. I went to Korea to get the component for them. I went to the chip manufacturer to procure chair for them.
Computer chips, yeah.
We did everything for them. And they just marketed the product, which we helped them build.
You were trying to get the cost of a plasma TV down to under $3,000, which would have been, which you did, and that was kind of crazy. How did you do that? How were you able to get them so much? You know, if they were selling for $15,000, how were you able to get them to get the retail price down to $3,000?
Yeah, the same thing I have been doing all my life, right? Simplify the supply chain and control costs. The supply chain at that time for Sony and Panasonic is Sony will build a TV in Japan, which is very expensive. They will build everything, right? They build even their own plasma screen.
They were vertically integrated, totally vertically integrated.
Completely vertically integrated. So they build it. It's already a little bit more expensive than it should. And they sell it to Sony US and another layer of margin, right? So Sony US has a big organization and they do Sony marketing. And was adding additional overhead, and Sony will probably sell it to a distributor. Distributor will add more margin. The distributor will sell to Circuit City at a time. The Circuit City will market plasma screen as their ultra high end for ultra rich, uber wealthy people, the billionaire in Beverly Hills, and they will. It's like white glove service, and they will mark out like 40 points.
So, what did you do to beat that? Like, what was your strategy?
I found the right factory in Taiwan that can build a lot cheaper than at the time the labor cost in Japan. And the components are the same. At the same time, we're vertically de-integrated and use that efficiency and we pass the saving to the consumer. So I went to Gateway and say, let's do the same thing we've done before. You have your own retail store. You don't need a lot of margin. You go direct.
When we come back in just a moment, how William's Gateway strategy to go direct gets derailed, leading him to start a new business and revive an old idea. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to How I Built This. Hey, welcome back to How I Built This. I'm Guy Raz. So it's 2004, and William has teamed up with his old partners at Gateway to sell affordable flat-screen TVs. And they're selling well at first, but then...
By 2004, Gateway was under a lot of pressure because the PC price went down even further.
Right.
And they had pressure to shut down the country stores because I think each store at that time is costing them like $1 million a year to run. So for 500 store, that's $500 million. So they had to shut down the store. But when you shut down the store, when people buy TV, they want to see it.
Right.
So they end up shutting down the store. Once they shut down the store, they say, we're going to get out of the TV business.
Which meant that you were going to focus on building out your brand, essentially.
Yeah. So I tried to license the brand from them. And they don't want to license to me. And I say... Okay, what I do, right? So I came out with my own brand called Vizio, and I went to the supplier, tried to get them to build TV for me.
But just to be clear, Gateway would not, even though they decided to get out of the business entirely, they would not license the brand name to you.
Yeah.
Well, so you decided, well, I'm just going to come up with a new brand name.
Yeah.
It's also an interesting time because most televisions in 2002, when you really, really when you launched Vizio, were still big rear projection, right, TVs. They were like huge, heavy things.
Yeah.
If you had a flat screen plasma TV, you were a very wealthy person.
Yeah.
So you start to produce these televisions, but I think you also did something which proved to be very prescient, which is you cut a deal with Costco, right, that they would sell your televisions. And did that happen almost immediately that you made that deal with them?
Yeah. So around, I think, 2004, 2005, I used to sell a computer monitor at Costco. So yeah. I know the people a little bit.
You had a connection there.
I had a connection there. So at the time, Costco had no market share for TVs. And
yeah, people didn't buy that at Costco at the time. They still mainly bought, you know,
yeah,
food.
Yeah, because people like Sony and Panasonic, and they don't want to deal with Costco.
Right.
They give Costco the leftovers because it's they want to protect their existing dealer relationship with Circuit City and Best Buy. So I went to Costco and say, you know, you guys are so aggressive in costs, and your biggest frustration is that you cannot get good brand product for you. Why don't you carry us? Let me prove to you that we can work together and disrupt the whole TV market. And they're very efficient because it's, at that time, their break-evens is around 9.5%. And they don't want to make money on merchandising anyway. They just want to make money on membership fee, right?
The membership fee, yeah.
And merchandising for them is a service for members. And with the same mentality, I say, I don't need to make a lot of money. I'm pretty small, but I can put together a great screen for you at $2,500. So we did a deal.
$2,500 that they would buy the televisions from you.
They would buy like $2,400, sell it for $2,500.
Wow. So their margins were, wow. And so all of a sudden, people would go to Costco and see these flat screen TVs for $2,500.
Yeah. Yeah. It was so like a hotcake. And the government was happy because it's, more people are buying digital TV. And Costco is really happy because all of a sudden there's somebody in the consumer electronics space. I started to grow my business.
What's remarkable is that there are parallels between the Vizio story and your previous company, the Mag, you know, the monitor company that really had this rapid rise and then a fall. But here, I mean, within a few years, you hit $700 million in revenue, right? Vizio, I think by 2007, so just a few years after you launch it, it was the number one HD TV brand in the U.S. It surpassed Samsung. It had a market share of like 14.5%. And from what I understand, that year you did about $2 billion in sales, which is remarkable. But what I'm wondering is, why didn't the big players see this coming? Samsung, Sony, Panasonic. I mean, why didn't they compete when they saw you selling these TVs at Costco and just selling these TVs like hotcakes?
Yeah, a legacy. I think their legacy relationship, their legacy business model, right? I mean, I picked a partner like Costco. I mean, all they need 9% to break even. You got Circuit City require, what, 25% to break even.
They had to make 25% margins to break even.
To break even. And so Costco clear was a winner. And also, right, we look at inventory control like a hawk versus big company like Sony and Panasonic. And for them to make a decision, the salesperson got to talk to their U.S. corporate. U.S. corporate got to talk to their Japanese counterpart. And Japanese counterpart got to go up. Is that 25? Well, I don't know how many tiers are reporting. We have one tier. So if we believe it's the right thing to do, we'll do it right away. So it's about efficiency. And we have, you know, a few people, and they have a lot of people.
I read a stat that you claimed it in 2007 that your overhead was 0.7% of sales. That was your overhead cost, and that your competitors, their overhead cost was 10% of sales or more.
I mean, yeah.
So your costs were a fraction.
Yeah.
Now, here's my question, though. I mean, you saw this happen in a different business before where you catch a wave. There's all this excitement, but then the other competitors come in. So I know you had this strategy of like, let's make cheap TVs, let's sell them to cut through Costco and then eventually Walmart and Kmart and others, but you must have known in the back of your mind that history could repeat itself, that very soon the big players were going to figure out how to make cheap TVs and go after your customers.
Yes, that was a tuition I paid dearly for.
When did that start happening? I mean, when did you start seeing the you know, some of these competing brands start to come in?
Right around the same time, there's a lot of people try to compete in the space. A lot of new brand came in. It was a brand called Olivia. Mm-hmm. Some of my suppliers even had their own brand. So I say, okay, well, we better be really efficient, be really smart, we better have better product, and we better have a better management team. So that means it's, I can't manage everything by myself, by technology anymore. I want a great team of people. So I start to hire who understand like finance better than me. So I start to spend a lot of time putting together a great team.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because Vizio's sort of, you know, your sales would go up and down and up and down. Like, 2007, I mentioned $2 billion in sales. But then there were some years, you know, where the sales were, you know, $3 billion, but then they would, then some years they went down to $1.5 billion. And I know that this is a tough business, right? And so was the outside pressure on your sales really just simply a matter of more competitors?
A lot of competition, right? But we invest heavily into the company. Mm-hmm. I think that kind of set us apart, right? I say this time around, I'm not going to be... Money's not the only thing, right? I want to make Vizio an enterprise. So we invest in the brand, we invest in the people. And around 2008, 2009, I think... God, my competitor on hardware is getting stronger and stronger.
Yeah.
Sooner or later, I got to add more value.
Right. And I guess to add more value, you revived this earlier idea you had about making smart TVs, because right back in the late 90s, when you tried doing that, it didn't work. But now you're talking about 10 years later, the technology is better. So I guess you went for it again, right?
Yeah. I went back to my roots. I say, we got to have recurring revenue. I said, how do we do that? We got to get TV connected to the internet again. I think instead of making money once on TV sales, the same customer probably come back 7 years later to replace their TV. I say, why don't we just make money every time people turn on the TV? How do we do that? And I started investing into internet TV in 2009. And we started shipping the first internet TV on the digital TV in 2009.
And did that really turn things around?
Yeah, actually. And we got Hulu, YouTube, and Netflix. Although it's not 100% of our volume, people respect that, right? So people say, well, what is the streaming?
Right.
We had the first Wi-Fi TV, and we had the first TV with a little keyboard, right? So you can browse the web. And back then, we teamed up was Yahoo, and they built the first operating system for TV for us.
Eventually, I mean, now we're going into 2024. I mean, you guys did eventually go public, but in 2024, you were outright acquired by Walmart. They bought Vizio for $2.3 billion. And Walmart, it's amazing, I read that, according to Walmart, 90% of Americans shop at Walmart every year. Tell me about the decision to go with Walmart, because I mean, you guys had gone public at one time. You were valued at $3.5 billion, and then the revenue, you know, the value had gone up and down. But you know, pretty good outcome, $2.3 billion to acquire the business in 2024. Was it kind of a relief for you when that happened, when that offer came through?
Well, it's bitter and sweet, right? As an entrepreneur, I don't think, you know, it's my intention to ever stop solving more problems for this industry. I love attacking, making TV better. So when they came to us and they wanted us to consider this deal, it was a tough decision for me. But if I look at what's best for the company, potentially this is big, right?
Yeah.
This is a lot bigger. I built from... This is way beyond my entrepreneurship now. Way beyond, right? We built a platform that, you know, last year we did over $700 million in media.
Yeah.
This is not something that's out of my garage anymore. This is an enterprise.
Right.
I think one of the happiest moments in my life, I told that to a lot of people, it's like 10 years ago when I walked into Vizio, I felt Vizio was bigger than me.
Right.
Right, which is what I want. It's like, I describe that to a lot of people. It's like having a daughter. I have a daughter, right? It's like someday you're going to walk down the aisle for her, with her, and marry her to somebody else. I mean, it's sad it's not your girl anymore, right? But it's actually great because that's the outcome you want. You want her to continue her own legacy. You want her to start her own family. You want her to create her own, chasing after her dream. So I couldn't find a better partner than Walmart to do that because they reach 90% of America.
Do you, when you think about, you know, what you built and what you achieved and everything that happened, I mean, how much of your success do you attribute to the work you put in, and how much do you think has to do with just getting lucky?
You know, okay, you need to define being lucky because I was very unlucky on the plane.
Yeah.
Singapore, I was really unlucky when I lost my first millions of dollars on my first business. I was very unlucky when I had a great idea on connected TV, smart TV, but I was way ahead of time. So I think my definition of lucky is always worry more about other people surrounding you than yourself. I think the luck doesn't drop out of the sky. You can't stay at home and be lucky. But luck is given to you by people around you. Mm-hmm. Right? And sometimes you never know who's going to make you, who's going to help you. Right? I wasn't lucky enough because I didn't hire good enough back 20, 30 years ago. But now I surround myself with very, very critical, very smart business people, a lot smarter than me. I'm lucky.
Yeah.
Because I have them.
That's William Wong, founder and CEO of Vizio. Hey, thanks so much for listening to the show this week. Please make sure to click the follow button on your podcast app so you never miss a new episode of the show. And please sign up for my newsletter at guyraz.com or on Substack. This episode was produced by J.C. Howard with music composed by Ramtin Arablouei. It was edited by Neva Grant with research help from Alex Chung. Our audio engineers were Robert Rodriguez and Maggie Luthar. Our production staff also includes Catherine Seifer, Iman Mani, Casey Herman, Sam Paulson, Chris Messini, Carrie Thompson, John Isabella, and Elaine Coates. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to How I Built This. If you like How I Built This, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.